From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
My guest is journalist Adam Higginbotham, and he's the author of the award-winning Midnight in Chernobyl, the untold story of the world's greatest nuclear disaster. And his work has appeared in many fine publications. And his latest book is Challenger, a true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. Adam Higginbotham, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
You had to become a real technical expert on the shuttle, as well as writing basically seven biographies in this book. Did you know anything about it going in?
I should say I did not become a technical expert. I consulted some people who were technical experts. I knew the broad outlines of the story enough to think that I might be interested in writing about it. And it was only really when I began digging into the background of it that I realized that, you know, what an incredible story it was, and how much I didn't know about it. And that was what really convinced me to write a book about it, is because I realized that, you know, I was around at the time. I remember I was 17 when it happened. But I realized that there's a whole, you know, there's a whole readership of people out there who weren't even born when it took place. And so I wanted to tell the whole story, and to tell the story, like you say, of all of the astronauts who were on the shuttle that day, because the story had so frequently been told through the lens of the experience of Kristen McAuliffe. But I wanted to tell the story of all of the astronauts, and also of the rocket engineers who tried to stop the launch happening in the first place.
Well, are you drawn to disasters, or is it the way the government handles the disaster? What is it that drew you to these two stories?
I definitely don't have a sort of ghoulish interest in catastrophe. But what I am interested in is the opportunity that these kinds of events present to look at human beings' behavior at their best and at their worst. So these kind of events obviously, you know, put people in under extreme circumstances. So you get to see their behavior. But also what Challenger and the Chernobyl accident both have in common is that they both represent an opportunity to look at a sort of cross-section of society through a single event. So in the case of Challenger, you have, you know, at one end you have Ronald Reagan, who's president at the time, and every layer of society, all the way down to the 14-year-old daughter of Mike Smith, the pilot of Challenger, who was watching from the roof of the Launch Control Center at takeoff. So it's really that kind of, it's the way that human beings behave, and also the way that human beings and technology interact with one another.
One of the things that struck me when the event occurred, and you start your book with this moment, is the contrast between Herb Morrison, who was the newsman on the spot when the Hindenburg exploded, and he said, "Oh, let's burst into flames! Oh, the humanity!" And the voice of, I think it's Steve Nesbitt, who says,
"Yeah,
flight controllers here, looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously, a major malfunction."
Right.
It's really an interesting. It's kind of that NASA, we don't ever, Roger, we copy your venting kind of.
Right. Well, I mean, I was that was one of the aspects of the story I was particularly fascinated by in retrospect. And so I spent a lot of time talking to Steve about to reconstruct how he came to that point. Because like you, it seems very striking. And I think that at the time, it was one of the ways in which NASA as an agency, as a group of people, you know, came off badly in the public eye, because it seemed to be an indication of just how kind of callous and inhuman they were, that somebody could watch this happen in front of them and say merely, obviously a major malfunction, which seems, you know, extraordinarily bloodless and strange. But it was because the reason it happened is because, you know, Steve Nesbitt was a former journalist, and he wanted to make sure that he got things right. But also he felt a real responsibility to everybody he knew who was listening live, not to mislead them, not to give them false hope, but not to overstate necessarily what had happened, because he couldn't tell, and nobody in the room in Mission Control could tell him what had happened. So that was the best he could do, you know. And he hesitated for 41 seconds, which in as you know much better than me, you know, in broadcast is an eternity.
A long time. Yeah. Well, let's back up a little. To what degree, Adam Higginbotham, did the Strategic Defense Initiative, if any, play in the role of in the pressure to launch the Challenger that day?
I'm not sure that it played any role in that. I'm not aware of any role, which is not to say there wasn't one, but certainly that wasn't anything that came up during my research.
Well, then there had to be something that was pressuring NASA from above to continue to launch the shuttles.
There were all sorts of things.
And was Ronald Reagan a part of that force?
Not in any way that could be explicitly proved or demonstrated. Uh-huh. And one of the aspects of the investigation that took place afterwards under William Rogers, to determine what happened and to try and make sure that it didn't happen again, you know, this was such an issue that they actually collected signed affidavits. The investigators who were sent out by the members of the commission collected affidavits from each person involved in the launch decision chain, testifying to the fact that they had not received explicit outside pressure to go ahead and launch. And part of the aim of collecting those sworn statements was to try and get to the bottom of this rumor that was circulated that the White House had pressured NASA to go ahead with the launch on the 28th because they wanted Christa McAuliffe to be in orbit during the course of the State of the Union address that the president was going to be delivering that night. So if that was the case, then it needed to get off the ground that morning in order for her to be in orbit at that time. But although that, you know, continues to be a widely circulated rumor, there is absolutely no evidence that that was the case.
So did you find any evidence at all so did NASA feel imaginary pressure or from the government, or was there actual pressure from the Reagan administration?
There was huge pressure within NASA because they had embarked upon the year of 1986 with a plan to make this the busiest year in NASA history for launches. You know, there was scheduled to be more than one launch a month. And they'd already been pushed back because the first launch of the year of Columbia in earlier in January that year, you know, that had been delayed a record number of times, which was a colossal embarrassment to the agency. So then when Challenger began to be delayed also and was delayed repeatedly for various different embarrassing reasons that led to them being humiliated by the media, you know, the pressure internally only mounted. And a lot of that was, you know, that was ambiently felt. They didn't need at that point to have anybody telephoning from the White House saying, you'd better get on with this. You've got to get the next launch off the ground because this is looking embarrassing. Because everybody felt it. You know.
I see. Well, the morning of the launch, the astronauts were quite sure that it would be delayed again. They didn't think they would go up that morning.
Yes, because it was so cold. Because there were icicles a foot and a half long dangling from the launch structure. You know, it was the coldest weather in Florida history. So each member of the crew was convinced that it was too cold to go ahead with the launch, simply from what they could see, you know, out of the windows of the crew quarters. To the extent that Mike Smith, who was the pilot, you know, had already made arrangements to have his wife and children flown home that afternoon in the expectation of the launch being cancelled so that the kids could get another couple of days of school back in Houston and then come down later in the week for Thursday, which is when, as far as he was concerned, looking at the weather forecasts, would be the next time it was possible to get off the ground.
There's so many horrible, ironic things that occur, which is kind of like Titanic. You know, I mean, Titanic could have avoided their disaster so many times if little tiny things had occurred. And there's lots of those in the story of Challenger, including the fact that they had scrubbed on a day that would have been a perfectly nice day.
Exactly, because they got a weather forecast on Saturday night that preceded Super Bowl Sunday that had told them there was this weather front coming in, which was going to bring with it lashing rain, lightning, a massive storm, and there'd be no way to launch under those circumstances. But the weather forecasting just proved to be wrong. So then the astronauts woke up the following day and opened the curtains in the crew quarters, and it was a beautiful, clear, blue sky day. It would have been a perfect day to launch. But of course, by that time, everything had been called off. The shuttle had not been fueled. So there was no way they could go.
Now, let's just say they'd gone that day, and because it was warm and nice, the O-rings and the whole thing didn't happen. Would it have just happened at a later date to some other crew?
There's every possibility that would have happened, because they'd already come very close to this kind of disaster happening on previous flights. The difference would be that the engineers at Morton Thiokol, who manufactured the solid rocket boosters, were already at work trying to fix the problem that ultimately caused the catastrophe, which was these artificial rubber O-ring seals sealing the joints between the joints of the rocket. And they had had a previous close call in January of 1985, almost exactly a year earlier, and were horrified by what they saw when they recovered the boosters from the ocean and saw that the O-ring sealing the joints had almost burned through. And one of the engineers in particular felt that this was almost certainly linked to the extreme cold weather. But he was reassured in the aftermath of that launch, when they went into the flight readiness reviews for subsequent launches, that because this was at the time a 100-year weather event, there was no way that they were going to see weather that cold again before they had the opportunity to fix the problem, because they recognized the problem and they were working on it. And so he, Roger Beaujolais, this engineer, was absolutely aghast when a year later he discovered that, you know, there was another 100-year cold weather event. So they just, as far as they were concerned, they were working on it. They just needed to fix it. They needed a bit more time. And so if they'd managed to get away with it in January 1986, maybe it would have been fixed before the next cold weather event. But having said that, one of the other engineers I spoke to who worked at Morton Thiokol said that the joint overall was so badly designed that if it wasn't for cold weather, something else could have caused a catastrophe just like that one.
So although cold weather caused this one, it was a crapshoot every time. I mean, maybe that's why you start your book with the Apollo 1 fire, because you're saying that space travel was never routine and never safe.
I'm saying two things. It was never routine, it was never safe, and that effectively NASA experienced the same accident over and over and over again. So the same kind of culture, the same sort of dangers, the same preparedness to ignore the opinions of mid-ranking engineers occurred with Apollo 1, occurred with Challenger, and then occurred with Columbia in 2003.
So we have this image of NASA. President Kennedy famously declared, we're going to go to the moon and come back safely before the end of the decade. And we didn't even have a rocket that would work then. And so these men heroically put their minds together and made this thing happen. And we don't think of them as, you know, as boobs who, or people who take life lightly.
No, but I don't think that they did.
Yeah. But yet they make these mistakes, and they're, after the Apollo missions, they seem to be a different organization.
Well, they were an organization that was still doing the same kind of thing, and they were still creating extremely experimental vehicles to travel into an unbelievably harsh environment. But they were having to do it with a lot less money and resources, and that's really the big difference. So right. They were under this financial and resource pressure that they had not experienced before.
And that was political.
Well, I mean, it was political. There was also a real, you know, financial reason for it, which was that when Kennedy announced the race to go to the moon, you know, the economic circumstances of the country were extremely different. By the time Armstrong and Aldrin walked on the moon in 69. You know, the Vietnam War was raging. The Great Society program was costing a huge amount of money. And the economy was on a downturn that by the time Nixon approved the space shuttle project in 1972, you know, it was roiled by runaway inflation, and the economy was in a disastrous state. So it was political in the sense that those decisions were ultimately made by politicians to withdraw funding from NASA, but there was economic realities behind it.
The space shuttle originally was supposed to be able to take astronauts to and from the moon where they might build a space station. Was that like the original idea?
The original idea was that there would be a space station in low Earth orbit, which was to be a way station for manned missions to Mars. So they're going to build these massive nuclear-powered rockets that would take large groups of astronauts to the moon, to Mars, on missions that would take years to complete. The rockets were so large that they would have to be assembled in space, in orbit. And to get those pieces up there, and before that, the pieces of the space station itself to construct the space station, they would need a space truck that would be an extremely resilient, reliable vehicle that could launch from the Earth, take things up into orbit, and then come back again and do it all again a few days later. And that was the space shuttle. But what happened was, because there was no money and no political will, as you say, to send people to Mars in the wake of the moon missions, first of all, the nuclear-powered rockets were done away with. Then it was decided that while one day we might be interested in having a space station in low Earth orbit, it was something that nobody was going to fund right now, so let's push that off into the future. And so then the only thing that was left of this kind of grand project was the space shuttle itself. And in 1972, they didn't really have, or in 1969, when they first started thinking about it, they didn't really have a role for what it was going to do once it got into low Earth orbit. But they figured that they needed something to continue the project of manned spaceflight. And that's really what lay behind the space shuttle project in the first place, was simple continuity.
Well, I guess you would, if you're launching from a space station, then you don't have to have the same kind of enormous rocket that you need to get out of Earth's atmosphere, right? So it would be...
Exactly.
Well, is that how the International Space Station was built, by pieces that were brought up there by the space shuttle?
Yeah. That's how it was done.
There are people, I heard somebody on the radio the other day who had no idea. This was like a panelist on a show, had no idea there was a space station in space right now.
Yes, one of the big differences, I think, between the space program now and the space program in 1969 is the lack of awareness. And I think that's partly because, you know, NASA has been extremely successful in its stated aim when it launched the space shuttle project, which was that it was going to make access to space routine. Now space travel has become apparently routine, is perceived to be something that just happens all the time. Although the truth is, of course, it's just as dangerous as it's always been.
Right. Today, while we're talking, and this is before, a while before we're airing this, there are two astronauts on the space station who are sort of stuck there because they're the ship that's to bring them back unexpectedly shut down. It's a Boeing ship, I think, that's supposed to be.
It is. The Starliner.
Yeah. So it's still happening, right?
It's still happening and it's still very dangerous. And the fact that they have to stay there while they check out the spacecraft that's supposed to take them back to Earth is an indication both of the fact that it is still extremely hazardous and the fact that NASA as an organization has learned some of these lessons, you know, over the years, because they're now extraordinarily careful about checking things out, making sure that they have considered every eventuality before, you know, putting human beings back into a spacecraft that is extremely risky.
Well, Adam Higginbotham, your book is called The Challenger, but it really is a history of the entire space shuttle program. And You write about the very first space shuttle mission. I think John Young was the captain of that. That was the most dangerous space flight in history because there was no unmanned version of it first. Is that right?
That's right. They'd never, it was the first time that NASA had ever flown a manned mission without having flown the spacecraft remotely, in experimental flights beforehand.
There was no
So,
dog or chimpanzee version.
no. And there was no, it's just going to go, it's going to go up towards orbit without anybody in it. And then we're going to, no, we're no, there was none of that. And that's why, it was regarded as the most dangerous test flight in history. And they were just unspeakably brave, in my opinion, to strap into that thing.
I remember when they landed, and it was a very tense moment whether that thing was going to actually come back down into the atmosphere.
Yes, many of the senior engineers involved admitted that they still didn't know whether it would work, because a lot of their understanding of how it would function was based on computer simulation.
You talk about the sort of Flash Gordon spaceship model that we used to have of the pointy thing, and how that wouldn't work, and how counterintuitive it is that you have to have a big blunt thing to enter the atmosphere rather than a point.
Yes, exactly. The pointy. I was pretty startled to discover that myself. As kind of the pointy rocket would actually just melt and disintegrate quite high in Earth's atmosphere and come back down to Earth as a sort of metal hail. But yes. There's a lot of there is a bit of physics in there, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing. So the big the capsule with the blunt end is really the model for safe re-entry.
Exactly, which is one of the reasons why the space shuttle eventually took what is, relatively speaking, quite an ugly form, I think.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't look like it's supposed to look.
No.
But I mean, I always thought the space shuttle was very cool, and I'm sorry that they don't fly them anymore. Why did they decide not to fly them anymore?
Because they decided it was too dangerous.
Really?
I mean, they in 2003, right before they lost Columbia in the second fatal accident where they lost another seven astronauts, there were plans to refurbish and refit the existing space shuttle fleet. And one of the engineers told me that under those circumstances, under that plan, it would still be flying today, which, would be kind of amazing, because that would be more than it's more than 40 years after it first launched a spacecraft flying that long.
Yeah.
But the Challenger accident, they felt that they learned the lessons, both the engineering and the institutional lessons from that. And then it was revealed after the Columbia accident that they had not. And so once it had seen through the successful construction of the International Space Station, then the White House decided that was enough.
Were you surprised that the woman, I think it was a woman, who reviewed your book in the New York Times book review had not remembered Columbia? Did you catch that?
I wasn't surprised by that because that is not uncommon to hear that, and I think there are very good reasons for that. One is really what lies behind one of my desires to write the book in the first place, was because anyone who wasn't around at that time would find it quite difficult to understand exactly how incomprehensible it was that something like that, the loss of a spacecraft live on television in front of millions of people, could be that could happen. And so, because at that time NASA had this reputation as being an almost infallible agency that was capable of achieving the almost impossible on a pretty regular basis. And so people just couldn't conceive that a disaster like that could happen. I mean, that was a belief that was shared by the public and by people who worked at NASA themselves. But once that had happened, when it happened again under similar circumstances and Columbia broke up on re-entry, it seemed less unbelievable because everybody knew it had already happened. I think that and the fact that it took place in 2003, so less than 2 years after 9/11, I think, people's expectations for national catastrophe had been changed permanently by by those two events, I think. For people of my generation, the Challenger accident and 9/11 are two of those events that stick in your mind as the ones where you remember exactly where you were when you heard that they happened. Columbia less so.
And because maybe there wasn't a the presence of Christa McAuliffe certainly makes a difference in the Challenger story. You talk about Christa McAuliffe having been on the Johnny Carson show, and everybody knew that she was going, and it just made the tragedy so much worse.
Yes, and I mean, in many ways, she'd become a national hero before she set foot on Challenger.
You have a little moment in your book where, as she's boarding Challenger on that day, that she has an expression of terror on her face.
Yes,
Where did you get that, and how do you know that?
because the astronaut support person, who was the final person in the Challenger cockpit before they closed the door, an astronaut named Sonny Carter, told someone I interviewed that soon after the accident happened. And that was the thing that really stuck in his mind.
Yeah, it was so interesting because if they thought that it would be scrubbed, they might not. Why would they be terrified? Did she get terrified every single time they boarded it? I don't
It
know.
had never got that close before, I don't think.
Yeah, the book is a real tragedy, and as you start th reading it and thinking about it, you think, oh yeah, there was this thing and it blew up, just like the Titanic sank and a bunch of people died, or the Hindenburg blew up and a bunch of people died. But then you realize, oh no, it's these people. It's this moment. It's kind of like the movie Titanic. You're watching the movie Titanic and it's called Titanic, so you know exactly what's going to happen in the movie. But you get all involved with Jack and Rose and their love story, and then they hit an iceberg. Oh my gosh, those guys are in trouble. So it's you achieve that in Challenger, Adam Higginbotham. You really give us this human story of these seven people and how they came to be on this mission. And it's very tragic.
Yes, that was one of the reasons that, I wanted to tell the wider story, is because I didn't think that without getting to know them and without getting to know, the engineers and the administrators who worked on the program in the years before the accident happened, I didn't think that you could really appreciate exactly what was lost, both personally to people like the members of the crew's families, but also to people who worked at NASA, or to, anybody who was watching it on TV that day. It's difficult to appreciate the magnitude of that without understanding what went before.
The engineer who really believed that it wasn't a good idea to fly and who tried so hard to stop the flight, what happened to him afterwards? What kind of feelings did he have?
Well, he was as shattered as all of the other Morton Thiokol engineers who watched the launch from their offices in Utah that morning. But what happened to him after that is that he realized, seeing the testimony of senior NASA officials and senior Morton Thiokol officials before the Roger Commission hearings, that they weren't telling the whole truth about what had happened, because they had this late night, last minute meeting the night before the launch, in which the engineer Roger Beaujolais and his colleagues recommended against launch, and they actually sent a written recommendation to NASA saying that they advised against launch. But then NASA officials put pressure on them to reverse that recommendation, and that recommendation therefore went from a no-go to a go. And the way that the officials talked about that initially in the first days of the Rogers Commission hearings was to acknowledge that they had a meeting and say, oh yes, we did have a meeting, and yes, there was some talk of cold weather and the fact that maybe we shouldn't launch, but in the end we all agreed that we would go ahead. But at no point did they admit that the Thiokol engineers had said don't launch. And so when he and his immediate boss, Al McDonald from Morton Thiokol, realized what was going on, they decided that they had to put up their hands and tell the full truth about what had happened, and effectively became whistleblowers. And as a result of that, Beaujolais and McDonald were frozen out by their colleagues at Thiokol. Senior Thiokol executives tried to exclude them from the company, and they were only restored to their original positions after Congress became aware of what Thiokol had been up to. But in the months and years after that, Roger Beaujolais' life was completely destroyed. He was unable to work at Thiokol. He was diagnosed with PTSD. And after the shuttle disaster, he never worked in the aerospace industry again. So although he was extremely heroic and very principled, he paid a terrible price for that.
In the Apollo 1 fire, where three, sort of classic astronauts who everybody knew and loved were killed, the NASA investigated. They were the head of their own investigation of the Apollo 1 fire. But after the Challenger explosion, NASA was not in charge of the investigation. Why? What was that? What was the decision there?
Well, initially they were put in charge of it for the first few days. But at that point, within a week of the accident happening, President Reagan's advisors, specifically his chief of staff, Don Reagan, realized that the political atmosphere and the media environment in 1986 was very different to what NASA had faced in 1967. And they realized that they could not be, in the wake of Watergate in particular, and the suspicions that had aroused both in Congress and in the media of potential government malfeasance, they realized that they couldn't afford even the slightest appearance of a potential cover-up. So they took responsibility for the investigation off NASA. And that only increased when William Rogers, who was the head of the investigation, that only increased when William Rogers, who was the head of the investigation, got wind of the fact that the senior NASA officials weren't being completely frank with him. And then they removed even the senior officials who were involved in the launch decision from participating in the investigation.
But there were astronauts on the panel.
Sally Ride was on the panel, and Neil Armstrong was on the panel. But neither of them, I mean, Neil Armstrong was long retired by then, but Sally Ride was certainly not involved in the launch decision chain.
Right. But they did have people with NASA experience and affiliation.
Yes. And there were, there were other people who were, General Donald Katina, who was the Air Force general who had been the head of the military part of the space shuttle program, was also a member of the investigation team. But as I say, none of them were directly involved. And then you had people like Richard Feynman, who was entirely independent to the point of being regarded by his colleagues as a loose cannon.
Yeah. And a very funny guy.
Yes.
So to come back to my original question about Star Wars, I'll tell you why I was wondering about it. Right after the explosion of Challenger, President Reagan, who didn't make his State of the Union address but did make a speech, in his speech, the first thing he says is, "This isn't the end of NASA. We will continue. This isn't the end of the space shuttle. The space shuttle will continue." Like, that was like the first assurance that he gave. And, maybe it should have been the end of the space shuttle, right? I mean, if it blew up, why would anybody want to get in another one?
Well, I mean, there was one very good reason for that, which is that in the hours after the accident, Vice President Bush flew down to Cape Canaveral to meet the family members of the crew. And the widows had agreed amongst themselves before that party showed up from Washington, D.C., that one thing they wanted to make very clear to the politicians who would be making these decisions and involved in these decisions was that their husbands would have wanted the space shuttle program to continue. They would have wanted manned spaceflight to continue. And so that's one reason why Reagan included that in his speech, because it was felt at the time that the way of honoring these people who'd given their lives in the interest of space exploration was to make sure that those initiatives continued.
Well, but wasn't the Strategic Space Initiative dependent on a working space program?
I'm not sure that's true, because by that time the Air Force had also returned to using expendable rockets in order to deliver satellites into space. I don't know that SDI was dependent on the shuttle itself, but then you're just revealing my ignorance of the strategic defensive. I just don't know enough about it to be able to say. And I did, and the truth is that there were these black missions, these secret space shuttle missions that took place before the accident. And we still don't really know what they were doing with those, because they were
Those are
completely.
still classified?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting that they would still be classified after how many years it's been, 40 years.
Yeah.
So it's possible.
It's possible that they were being used to test things that were parts of the SDI program, but I just don't know.
Yeah. Well, it'd be for volume two, the Challenger part two. So let's talk a little bit about the orbiter after the explosion. It's pretty, I mean, initially we thought that it just evaporated and everything blew up and they were just instantly killed and destroyed. But you found evidence that that's not exactly true.
Well, I think that what happened is that NASA allowed the public to think that, because anybody who watched the footage, which was played so many times and replayed so many times on television, would naturally draw that conclusion, because what happens is the spacecraft disappears into a massive white orange cloud of fire, and it does not reemerge from the other side. The two booster rockets spiral off in opposite directions across the sky. But Challenger itself has gone. So it seems obvious to anybody looking at that television footage that that's what happened, that the crew were instantly immolated or vaporized. But analysis of the film of that happening from the high speed cameras that NASA had on the ground, and then the analysis that the doctors and accident investigation staff performed on the wreckage that was recovered from the ocean months after the accident happened, revealed that was not the case, and that what in fact happened was that the crew compartment of the shuttle, which was a self-contained pressurized vessel that fitted within the nose of the fuselage of Challenger, emerged intact from the fireball and continued on an upward trajectory, and that the aerodynamic forces that had caused the breakup of Challenger during the moments in which all of that fuel caught fire in the sky were not sufficient to kill the members of the crew, and almost certainly not enough to render them all unconscious. And so the investigators found evidence from within the cockpit that each of the seven members of the crew were probably alive, and some of them may even have been conscious for the time it took for the crew compartment to fall from its apogee to the surface of the ocean, where it was destroyed in impact. And that fall took about 2.5 minutes.
So we can't see that happening because it's happening 9 miles and up, and it's too small for us to see with our naked eye in the piece of film that we've seen. But you can
Yeah,
see.
I mean, if you look at it now, if you see the enhanced imagery that NASA used to determine this for themselves, you can actually see there's a small triangular object emerging from the fireball. And when the astronauts are examining the film on a light table at the Johnson Space Center, took a look at it, you could actually see sunlight glinting on the windshield of the crew compartment as it spun, as it fell.
So, have you seen this high speed footage that they, you said 45 frames per second as opposed to 24 frames per second kind of movie. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen the stills of it, yeah.
And also the audio that was, you talk about how they found the tapes and were able to, even though they were, had been underwater and exposed to extreme heat, that they were able to reconstruct these tapes. Have you heard the audio?
No, and neither of any members of the family of the crew. Only people within NASA have listened to those tapes. And, the New York Times and other media outlets repeatedly attempted to get NASA to release those audio recordings at the time, but failed.
And they still won't release them.
Not as far as I know, no.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating, and horrible to think that they, I mean, it's kind of more comforting to think that they just didn't know what happened and it just blew apart, as to think of them, spending 2.5 minutes plummeting.
Yes, it certainly is. But we have to say we don't have any hard evidence for how many of the crew were conscious, but there's certainly evidence that at least two of them were probably conscious.
Could there have been some kind of a way to, if this thing was, if the capsule that they're in was a separate thing, couldn't it have had separate parachutes or safety involved that would have enabled it to land safely rather than crash into the ocean?
Well, this is one of the reasons that that when the news emerged that the crew had probably survived the breakup of the orbiter, it was so controversial, was because by that time, the investigation, the Rogers Commission, and the hearings had demonstrated that the shuttle was the first spacecraft in NASA history that did not have an escape mechanism to rescue the astronauts in the event of a catastrophe during the launch phase. And if there had been such an escape system, then during that 2.5 minutes, they may have been able to escape with their lives before the crew compartment struck the surface of the ocean.
But I mean,
But
it's, yeah.
it did, but no such escape system existed, and it had been excluded from consideration very early in the design of the orbiter, largely for cost reasons. And one of the most disturbing pieces of information I came across during my research was this memo from the early 1980s, which suggested that even after the shuttle had started flying, after the first shuttle launch in 1981, there was internal consideration of a redesign for the shuttle orbiter system to, re-engineer it to include an escape system like that. And that they eventually decided not to do that, not for engineering or cost reasons, but because they feared that if the public discovered that they were considering installing an escape system into the shuttle, then they would realize that the shuttle was much more dangerous than they'd been led to believe.
But of course, space travel is never routine and never safe.
Right, but that was counter to the whole impression that the public was allowed to draw from the way in which the shuttle flew frequently and apparently without incident in all the years before Challenger happened.
We're talking with Adam Higginbotham, and his new book is called Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. And I think I got from your book that really it was the design of the rockets that is the sort of germ of this disaster. That is the solid rocket booster versus a rocket that had fuel that could be throttled down. Is that where
Right, a liquid fueled rocket would have been much more controllable. Yes, exactly.
And so why didn't they have a liquid fueled rocket instead of a solid rocket booster?
Because they would have been much more expensive and much more temperamental. And it was a key element of the shuttle system that it be at least semi-reusable. So this was the first reusable spacecraft in history. The whole idea of it was that it would launch into space and return to Earth, almost on an airline schedule. And in the initial designs, when you see conceptual drawings of the shuttle that were produced in the early 70s. It's represented as something that would take off from the launch pad like a rocket. It would go into orbit. It would orbit the Earth like a spacecraft, and then it would glide back to Earth seamlessly and land on an airstrip, just like a commercial airliner. And then in these conceptual drawings, you see illustrations of white-suited engineers just kind of rolling these moving staircases up to the sides of the orbiter, you know, changing the oil, wiping down the windshield, and then taking it back out to the launch pad for another go around, you know, within a couple of days. And so that reusability was central to how it was supposed to work. And the problem with the liquid fueled boosters would have been that they were designed to parachute back down into the ocean. And so the complicated plumbing of liquid fueled rocket engines would not have reacted well to that. And so they wouldn't really have been very easily reusable. Whereas the solid rockets were just regarded as big metal tubes that were filled with solid rocket propellant, not much different from giant fireworks. And so once they were lit, they stayed lit until all of that propellant inside had burned out. And what really parachuted back to Earth was just the empty metal cases.
Yeah. And that, but that's where the O-rings are in those solid rocket boosters.
Because they were so, the solid rocket boosters were, while being in principle a lot like fireworks, in scale, were completely different. They were 150 feet high and 12 feet across. So they were absolutely massive. And they were built at a plant in northern Utah by Morton Thiokol. And so they had to be transported all the way across the country in order to reach Cape Canaveral for launch. And not only were the rockets too physically large to be carried on railroad cars across that distance, but if they had been carried in a single piece, the potential for catastrophe, if there had been an accident and one rocket in a monolithic piece had exploded, then it would have been utterly devastating. So it was simply much safer to make them in these four main sections and transport the sections separately across the country by rail, and then fit them together, stack them up one piece on top of another at Cape Canaveral, and seal the joints with metal pins and with these artificial O-rings, which would make the joints ideally gas tight.
Which, no spoilers here, but they weren't. How did Thiokol get the job? Were they the only company that could possibly have done it, or were there other bids?
No, there were other bids, but Morton Thiokol's was among the lowest bids. And they also had a huge amount of experience with this kind of rocketry. But principally, they came in with a very low bid.
And so was there corruption in that company that was uncovered in the investigation, or it's just bad luck?
I don't think you could call it corruption. I think that there were commercial interests involved. And so the night before the accident took place, in this teleconference that they had between engineers and managers at Morton Thiokol in Utah and the NASA managers at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, which was the center of NASA rocketry, and middle managers at Cape Canaveral. You know, in that meeting, the senior Morton Thiokol managers by that time knew that their contract to manufacture these rocket boosters for NASA, which was worth around $1 billion, was under jeopardy of being put out to tender to competitors, so that NASA would have two sources of manufacturing the rockets for future shuttle missions. And so the Thiokol managers were acutely sensitive to not wanting to upset their principal customer. And the NASA middle managers made it very clear, without being explicit, but it was clear from the way they reacted to this news that Thiokol didn't want them to launch, that they did want to launch, and that they did want to go ahead with the launch. and they would really prefer it if Mort and Thiokol changed their minds and reversed themselves. So that commercial pressure was very much at the forefront of the minds of the Thiokol managers responsible for reversing that decision and therefore overruling their own engineers.
Well, obviously, you did an astounding amount of research, Adam Higginbotham, to write this book. And I wonder, who did you talk to among the astronauts? Did you talk to the families of the astronauts who perished in the explosion?
Yes, I did. I spoke to families and friends of the astronauts, of each member of the crew.
And their children, who must be all grown up and so on.
Yes. I spent a lot of time talking, especially to Alison Balch, who Alison Smith at the time, who was the 14-year-old daughter of Mike Smith. So it was very important to me to get a kind of a real sense of what the crew, each member of the crew, was like in the years before the accident, and why they had wanted to become astronauts, and what kinds of people they were. Not just to dwell on the details of the day of the accident itself, but to place their lives in its full context.
Judy Resnik was the second woman in space. Was she the first Jewish person in space?
I think she was, although she did not like to make a big deal of that.
Do you think that if she hadn't been Jewish, she might have been the first woman in space? Just wondering.
I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think that her personality, particularly the fact that she, was quite impatient with some of the public affairs duties required of an astronaut. Quite understandably, she did not enjoy interactions with the press. But when you see those interactions with the press now, in retrospect, it's completely understandable. She appeared on one of the morning shows in the run up to the launch of the first shuttle in 1981, and she was asked on air whether she was too cute to be an astronaut, which for an engineer as massively overqualified for the task of being an astronaut as Judy Resnik was, must have been infuriating. And she, to her credit, just kind of grins and rolls with it. But after another 5 or 6 years of that, your patience would really be wearing thin, I think.
And in the book, you said that she wasn't particularly pleased to have Christa McAuliffe because she thought, that was a place that people who had been waiting for years for a seat on the space shuttle weren't getting. But then she learned to really appreciate Christa McAuliffe.
Yes, but I mean, a lot of the astronauts felt that way about the space flight participant program. So the politicians that flew before Christa McAuliffe did, Bill Nelson and Jake Gunn. Bill Nelson, who's now the administrator of NASA, was mocked behind his back by the astronauts on the crew that he flew with, for precisely that reason. These people were regarded initially by at least some of the astronauts as interlopers who were taking seats that could otherwise be taken by people who'd been waiting, in some cases decades to fly into space.
Did you talk to Christa McAuliffe's family as well?
I did not. The most telling detail that informed my decision, I didn't even try to contact Steve McAuliffe, Christa's widower, because although June Scobee, who is the widow of the commander of the flight, Dick Scobee, is still in regular contact, as many other members of the families are, with Stephen McAuliffe, and said that she would, forward a message to him from me if I wanted to. I read a piece that he wrote for the local paper in Concord, I think around the 20th anniversary, I may be misremembering this, of the accident. But he says at the end of that piece, that this will, the Challenger accident will never be a historical event for me and my family. It's always as if it happened yesterday.
Always a current event. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought that that was both as eloquent a statement as you could make about his experience and his family's experience as you could want, but also a perfect explanation of why he has not talked about it to anyone in the media or a historian or a reporter ever since the day of the accident.
Well, in this book, you really achieve making it all current events. And the book is called Challenger, A True Story of Heroism and Disaster on the Edge of Space. And the author, my guest, the brilliant Adam Higginbotham, thank you so much for spending some time talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Tonight on the show, we have the person, the lady who was chosen as the first civilian astronaut to go into space. She is a teacher. Her name is Krista McAuliffe. She is a high school teacher from Concord, New Hampshire. And she was recently selected by NASA from a field of over 11,000 applicants to be the first, as they call it, average citizen in space. I remember when they talked about this a year and a half ago, about having a civilian go into outer space. And I guess the reason they did that, you probably know better than I, is to so somebody could come back and report not from a so much as a technical sense or engineering sense, but what a person who is not basically a scientist would feel like, and to be able to communicate that to other people. Is that basically the idea?
Well, NASA has a space participant program. I'm the first category.
Right.
And there will be other ones. And what they were trying to do, I think, was probably twofold. One, to give people a little bit of ownership in this program.
Right.
The space program belongs to everybody. And the other thing was to try to find somebody who would be a very good communicator and would impact on as many people as possible. And what better person than a teacher?
How long will this mission be? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, it's going to be 6 days.
6 days?
Yeah, and every 90 minutes I'm going to be orbiting the Earth at 17,000 miles an hour. And I really hope to get on the treadmill around California and jog across the United States.
While you're in space? It sounds absolutely fascinating. You seem to be handling it very well, and I think they made a very good choice.
Because I
think you can communicate this to most of us who really can't understand all of that. You're excited to go, huh?
Oh, I really am. I can't wait.
Hey, I thank you for being with us tonight. I wish you well. I think the whole country wishes you well.
Oh, thank you.
And give it. I'm going to tune in. I've got a satellite dish. I'm going to tune in.
Oh, please do. But I don't.
Do you have an early morning class, or what time of class? What time will the class be exactly?
I'm not sure, but I'm sure it will be broadcast so that everyone will know.
I'll watch. Thank you, Chrissy.
Congratulations. Thank
you. Fascinating.
Yes.
There is an experience in life that very few people.
That's right.
Will ever have the chance to participate. Would you like to?
I'd love to do it.
Wouldn't
yeah,
you like? Sure. Boy, would they need a booster.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.